Okay, Howard.
About question four, much of the current work being superfluous, so how would populations adapt? Well, that's sort of framed to suggest that somehow people would get fed up because they didn't have enough work to do, or they wouldn't know what to do with themselves. I don't think anything can be further from the truth, really. I'm sure that's not what you were trying to express there, Janet, but it could come across as that. Because I think in socialism, people would have plenty of things to do. I think the two main things they'd be able to do that they can't sort of, most people can't do effectively now, is first of all to... we'd be able to express our, if you like, inner nature, to reach our potential in all sorts of different ways that we can't in capitalism because of the constraints of the wages system. In 1962, Abraham Maslow wrote a book called Towards a Psychology of Being, in which he talked about man's need for self-actualization. And I think that actually expressed it very well. So that's the first thing. I think we'd be able to reach our potential or various different potentials. The second thing is that we'd be able to feel useful in a way that we do far less in today's society. We'd be able to be part of a real commune. We'd be able to commune with others, to be part of a real community, you know. All right, to a certain extent, people do commune with others now, often in their local community. People sort of do things together and so on. And when it's not mediated by money, that's fine. But as soon as money sort of comes into it, then problems are caused. You wouldn't have those problems in socialism. You'd be able to commune with your fellow human beings. This would be a way of flourishing because it would be a way of feeling useful to others and performing helpful tasks and creating things that others would appreciate, and in turn you would appreciate the fact that, you know, others found what you did useful and possibly beautiful.
It becomes creative, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. I do get that. And I mean, for myself, we've been retired nearly 25 years, and we never have a minute spare in a day. We're busy with all kinds of things involved with the community as well, in whatever way we can, and we get an awful lot from it. But I was really more thinking about the people who are involved with the making money, you know, the banks and the insurance and the unending list of jobs with that, which for me, that would be so boring for me. I would hate to have to think I had to go and do something like that. Can't help wondering about if people have got the mindset that that sort of thing is useful work. I wonder, we would have certain things that would be useful, that they would get involved in, I suppose, but I don't know. I just want to hear what people have to say about it, because it's not everybody sees that there is something other than work, do they? Unfortunately, because it's almost like people get brain dead because of it, and I think some people might find it difficult to know how to fill their time.
Dougie?
Hello. Yeah. I'm just thinking about question one, about the difference between both urban and rural or whatever. In Britain, you know, the government's had a policy about keeping the green belt or whatever. And, you know, certain people have tried to erode that policy. But it did mean that you can go out of London maybe about 20 minutes or something like that, and you're in the green belt or whatever. And that's one of the things that you notice in America, that you don't have that kind of thing. Where, you know, I remember reading a Bill Bryson book, and he actually praised Britain for protecting the green belt or whatever. And what one thing I'd like to say about work is, you know, in capitalism, they're making the retirement age later and later. I think in socialism, people might be able to retire in their 50s or whatever and still do socially useful things. But, you know, you wouldn't have to work until you die or whatever, which is what capitalism seems to want, really.
Yeah. Interesting you said about the Green Belt. You just made me think of the town. When I was a kid, up till 18, I lived in a village 2 miles from Rotherham, South Yorkshire. And I've just seen fairly recently online that this, what was when I was there all those years ago, it was a very, very industrial town. There were mining areas around. It was all iron and steel and all things that went with that. So the town was often very filthy. And I know going to school, you would get these smog days and we would all have to wear our torn up pillowcases as masks so that we didn't sort of, they were filthy, like when you'd got to school and then when you got home for dinner again as well. But I just saw this lovely thing online from Rotherham. They're transforming all their, what do you call the bits at the side of the road that could be
verges.
The verges, all the road verges. They've been scattering wild flower seeds, and there's some lovely photographs of how it's doing. So you've got miles and miles of this around this what was once a horrible, filthy town. So I just felt really glad that I knew about it, that it hadn't happened without me knowing.
Hi, Janet. Question 4.
Yes.
What about the right to be lazy? You know, why do we, this whole, we see in this day and age, we have this religious Protestant work ethic. And we look at places like the Brazilian jungle, and we see tribes that apart from going out to gather food or to hunt, they basically lie around in hammocks all day. And we in the West can't, well, they're lazy buggers. You know, we don't understand that. So I think, you know, it's going to have to take quite a bit of a difference in mindset to literally enjoy actually doing very little. They spend time with their families, with their kids, you know, just lazing about.
Yes. And what's the other, I haven't seen anything of it lately, but a handful of years ago, there was a group of people about this, the right to be lazy. It wasn't exactly the right to be lazy. Somebody can tell me about it, I'm sure. And it was a similar thing. And they have all kinds of activities and talks and things about it, treating it in a different way. But really just saying that exactly what you said, really, that there's... You don't have to have 24 hours of the day filled up with what's considered by the working folk, like you said a moment ago, as vitally important. A lot of the stuff isn't vitally important. What is important is to be able to get inside your own head. And somebody's whispering in my ear here, and meet the needs of the community. He's right, but it wasn't quite where I was going. But it's that thing of the involvement, being lazy. I'm never quite sure when people say someone is lazy. I think it's perhaps if they're doing something, the other person is lounging about on a settee or something. I don't know. I don't see anything wrong with people sitting around doing their own thing, which might be nothing, going through their thoughts. I think it's a very good idea that people could have the time to do nothing.
Okay, Adam, are you around? I know you can't get into the speaking queue.
Yes, I am, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, something's worrying me. It's the claim that most food in the world is produced by small farmers. Wheat, for instance, is mainly produced in big farms in Canada, Australia, Argentina, I don't know, and places like that. And I don't know about the other main staple traded on world market.
Right. Fed, isn't it?
You know, I can't believe that is the case. I mean, maybe if say 50% of the world's population are subsistence farmers, they're producing their own food, but I can't see that they're producing enough food to feed the people in the other 50% of the world. I'd like to see the evidence that the small farmers do produce most food in the world. And the other thing, of course, is that it isn't just farmers that produce food. It's the whole of society in the end. I mean, the farmers need irrigation. Farmers need tractors. That is, if you like, it's the whole population that's the whole productive population that's not those who are actually at the on the. And I just want to end as I've got the floor with a quote from the Communist Manifesto. Point 9 of the famous 10 points is combination of agriculture with manufacturing industries, gradual abolition of all the distinction between town and country by a more equitable distribution of the populace over the country. So that socialists have been talking about removing the difference between town and country for over 150 years. But anyway, the main point I wanted to make was to sort of challenge this figure that most of the food in the world is produced by small farmers. I find it hard to believe.
Janet?
I know I've got it written down here somewhere. Where a very recent look online, the latest figure from authorities, whatever you...
Campesina, I think.
No, it's not the Via Campesina. It's that it's about 70%. It is going down, but it's about 70% of. I know you talk about wheat being grown, like you say, but you've got to think about other parts of the world where you've got massive populations where wheat isn't their crop. It would be rice and that small grain, name escapes me at the minute, millet. And other things like that, and that in fact the great claims from the mega corporations about what they produce, yes, they do produce a lot, but in fact it's still I'll find it and I'll send it to you the link that I've used. So I believe it's going down because the big companies take over more and more, but of course an awful lot of what they do produce are not the actual things like the wheat, which is obviously very important, and a lot of that will be Canada and the United States, won't it?
Russia.
And then what was the other thing I was just going to say? Lost my thread there. Yes, about the other... The things that the mega farms, the agri, what do you call them? The
mega agriculture.
Big agricultural firms produce are things that they are that they actually put people off the farmland to produce the crops like the palm oil and all those sort of things that you find in just about everything that you use without even knowing it. You know, from edible stuff to soap to God knows what. But yeah, anyway, I will check that out and I'll put it on here for anybody who wants to see it at some stage and I'll send it to you, Adam. Okay.
Okay.
Malcolm, do you want to come in or is you just want to, you just put a link up here?
No, just a link to the right to be lazy. was unaware of it. I wanted to read it. Quite a famous pamphlet, obviously.
Oh, right, the Lafargue, yeah. Janet, did you tell us what you see? I mean, you've asked us what we see. What do you see?
You've probably heard some of that with when I've responded to people.
Yeah,
it's not that I didn't have any ideas of my own, but I just wanted to... hear how other people felt about them all. I think for me, one of the crucial parts of this is there are so many problems with the division that we've got for both rural and urban dwellers. That's all tied up with the system that we've got. Obviously, that's really what the problem is. But I see the other thing coming, the looming problem of the global warming, which is causing such problems in so many places. The latest being lots of the information coming out now about the peat in the Arctic area from Siberia all around and Canada and whatnot, and the problem that that's going to cause with the emissions of not just carbon dioxide but methane, which will be the really big thing, will make more and more changes. And it's compressing the time and how people all around the world can cope with it, knowing that it's going to affect it in such a way that you're going to have mass migration, which nobody chose to mention this evening. Or I know I did mention it earlier as one of the reasons really having to know what we think about the fact that so many people are going to have to move, and how are we going to feel about that? How are we going to deal with that? How are they going to be accommodated where they go? I suppose at the back of my mind, I've got more concerns than answers to anything.
Yeah, I share those concerns. Mass migration you talk about, that's war. I mean, we do already have mass migration, but that's through war and strife. I would imagine that there wouldn't be so much mass migration if we're able to feed everybody. The reason people move about is because either they're fleeing war or they're fleeing famine, and usually the two are connected. Alan, I think you want to come in.
Yeah,
it's really becoming so serious now. It's the inundation problems. Bangladesh is already being inundated. It's a very low-lying country. It has enormous farmland, but what's happening, it's becoming so serious, the constant flooding, that they won't be able to continue to grow. And that's happened, and it's either inundation or, in different places in the world, it's total drought where they have to move because they can't grow anything anymore. There isn't any water. And very, very recently, what's come up is the Himalayas, the borders of the mountains between India, Pakistan and China, that area. It's come to light that is there's been more melt from the ice there than has ever been known before, and again that's going to it will cause flooding, but it will also eventually, in not too distant future, will not be enough water for irrigation. So, you know, there are lots of areas in the world where people are going to have to move. They won't have any choice. I mean, what about, I'm sure you've probably seen things online where people have shown what 5 centimetres, 10 centimetres, 20 centimetres of sea rise will cause for big cities. Think of how many big cities around the world are actually right on the sea, or a river sea by level, the sea. Yeah. They're at sea level. Mm-hmm. New York is one, isn't it? London is another one. They've got dikes and stuff that will last for so long. I mean, but they were all man-made anyway. You know, they reclaimed land some years ago. But yes, eventually it will. And so some of the very, very big towns around the world, people will be having to leave them. You can go online and see that. You can see like a map where they show you how much of that will be underwater with different levels of sea rise.
Right. Alan, did you want to come in here?
Well, yeah, I mean, Janet's basically said it. I mean, it's the catastrophe that is happening. It's happening. Nothing's going to stop it from happening. Sea level rise, inundation, flood, drought, hurricane, all this is happening now. And we look at the world and we look at the so-called leaders of the world, and what are they doing about it? They're doing absolutely nothing. They're doing absolutely nothing. They're in competition with each other, for Christ's sake. You know, what's the matter? It's hard to get your head around the Brzezinski. Who's the other asshole in America? What's his name? I can't think what his bloody name is. I mean, Janet and I are losing. Janet and I are losing our fucking brains. I'm sorry to use such language, but we struggle to thread things together sometimes. I'm full of admiration for the fact that she's come on here and delivered a talk. I know what a struggle it is for her. What's the bloody man name? What's the man? Kissinger, for Christ's sake. These people, there are people out there, and the UK is not exempt from them. Europe is not exempt from them. Russia, China, they're not exempt from them. These people who have no grasp of the fact that, or it seems they have no grasp of the fact that the world as we know it is coming to an end. I don't know. There's probably no time for we socialists, we people who believe in a better world. There's probably no time for us. Mother Nature is going to wash us away. I'm afraid I'm of that. What's the word? Feeling. I have that feeling about it. We're going to be washed away, so many of us, because we failed to nurture the very earth upon which we depend. Socialism, communism, yeah, it doesn't matter what political persuasion you are, there is no future for us. I'm going to end there. I'm sorry, I go rattling on.
Howard, have you anything more optimistic?
Yeah, no, sorry. I've lost the will to live. Sorry. I won't say what I was going to because, as I say, I've lost the will.
Okay, Howard. Paul?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think we can all relate to Alan's frustration and anger and how overwhelming it is sometimes. I think... It just occurs to me, and you wonder what's going to happen to all the pen pushers in the current system, with all the bankers and stuff. And then you realise, well, there will always be the need for statisticians. And I was a factory worker most of my life, and I don't mind getting my hands dirty, but I certainly dislike paperwork to an absolute passion. It really, really grinds me down. So therefore, it kind of gets to the back to the fact that we will all have a role to play in some sort or another. Not everyone is green-fingered and has happy times, planting seeds. There are some people who are in their glory, in their element, and like nothing more, believe it or not, than sitting in front of a computer, doing paperwork. When I think about, problem solving and you look at this issue about, part of the world having too much water and another part of the world not having enough, then you start and you stop to think about how we managed to successfully transport oil around the world from one extreme to another, a combination of boats and pipelines traveling, you know, right across the world in a network of as I say, not hoses, but certainly giant turbines and such. And I would have a bit of a job with a garden hose trying to drain some of the swamps or rid some of the water issues in some parts of the world. But, you know, we've got this idea of, well, it's not an idea, this fact that icebergs are melting and some parts of the world are at risk of flooding, are being flooded, and yet others are crying out for water, both drinking and just you know, water in general. So then you think, well, why not? You know, within capitalism, the cost of transporting water around the world excludes it from being realistic. But then in socialism, when money is not a consideration, I'm sure that as human beings and problem solvers, we probably have got the capacity to find a way of transferring water around the world in much the same way as we do oil, and I think that in all probability will become quite realistic. You know, I don't think there's any reason why it can't be done. If it can be done with oil, it can certainly be done with water, and therein lies one potential threat. You know, and this, what's that old saying about Muhammad and mountains and Muhammad? You know, if you can't do one, then do the other. And certainly within socialism, there'll be a lot more thinking out the box without the consideration of financial costs. Okay.
Yes, thank you. Sorry if people saw some of this as, pessimistic. I suppose, you know, we choose to be optimistic, pessimistic or realistic. And I've got myself a sign that I made because I know sometimes I feel that, am I being pessimistic here? If I'm looking at this, reading this and finding it's a bit of a bring down. But truly, I think it's about being realistic. Optimism might be nice, but there's no point in being optimistic if you haven't got something which will back up the optimism. I can certainly be optimistic about certain things, but I think I have to take the realist viewpoint on whatever I can.
But I think very much saying Janet is perfectly reasonable. I think life is full of challenges, both personal challenges and societal challenges. And the challenges that we face in socialism will be able to be solved much better than they will be within capitalism. Because as I said in one of my final sentences earlier, you will not have the constraints of money. Of course, there will be other considerations, including the impact on society, yes, but environmentally too. But the one thing that will be missing will be cost consideration in terms of monetary terms. So those challenges will be far, there will be huge challenges, but they'll certainly be far easier addressed without the need to consider financial costs.
Howard, you didn't do it then.
Okay, I've got to say this. We're supposed to be talking about how things would be organised in socialism, not bemoaning the ills of capitalism, which we all know about. You know, we all know if things carry on as they are, we'd probably go to hell in a handcart, etc. But, and it's easy to, in talking about small farmers and the role they play and so on, that's the current context. It doesn't mean to say that in a socialist society, the main source of food would be small farmers. I mean, for example, in the book which I talked about a few weeks ago called Sitopia, how food can save the world, the author there talked about these food factories which were sort of built on different levels and which produced a massive amount of food. without soil through other mediums and so on. She didn't suggest that solution, but and I noticed that Paddy in his talk on Sunday mentioned the same thing. So we've got to be imaginative and not imagine that socialism is simply a rejigging of capitalism and we'd have exactly the same context and the same way of producing things.
He's right.
Thanks.
Keith?
Thank you, yes. Optimism and pessimism. There was an Italian Marxist called Gramsci who talked about pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will.
Now,
there are various ways that you might take that. But what I take it to be pointing out is you can set yourself two kind of questions. You can ask yourself how things are, and you can ask yourself what do you want to do about it. Now, the answer to how things are, the question how things are, they're bloody. But that's only half the picture. We're agents, we can do things, we can modify the world, change the world. And that's where optimism of the world is important. However bad things are, you have to answer, well, where do I want to put my effort? Do I want to leave them? Do I want to try and make it? And I think all of us as socialists say, we want to bloody well try. I hope that cheers Howard up a bit.
Keith, you were coming in and out a bit there, but I get the gist of what you're saying, and I absolutely agree with you. I suppose the difficulty is we don't know when we're going to be there. We can work for it, we can speculate about it, we can put all our good ideas for it. Absolutely, we can. Absolutely no doubt about it. And I wish we were there.
Paddy?
Yeah, just on this optimism thing, I think socialists by and large are optimists. I don't think we could do what we do if we didn't have a sort of hopeful view of the future. I think we'd all just curl up our tootsies and give up. And one thing I like about science reading, I'm not a scientist, but I read about this. I read the science press, and follow it. And one thing I like about it is this kind of this sense of potential that exists. It's not just kind of the next gadget. It's long term potential. It's the sort of things that Howard was talking about in Sitopia, and the sort of things that can be done and might be done in the future, like the picture of the vertical farm installation that Malcolm put up in Singapore. There's some absolutely fantastic things that can be done, things that are on the horizon now. And I think that it's, that's what I really like about science and just following it. I think it's just inspiring what people come up with, the ingenuity that, and let's remember who these people are. This is the working class where all this ingenuity is coming from, because the capitalist class are just a bunch of fat parasites who don't contribute anything. So it's the working class that's got this enormous ingenuity, the constant. And if you look at the science press, it's pretty easy to read. It's written for lay people, and just look at that, and you will. I think you kind of. You imbibe optimism from that. I mean, it has to be said, though, that that scientists tend to be a bit idealistic about the world. And, when they're talking about climate change and they're talking about technical fixes, they don't really kind of quite have their feet on the ground when it comes to how capitalism operates and how venal governments are. So, I mean, there is that side of it. But generally, I do think you need to leaven this kind of realism that Janet calls it with a sort of sense of the potential that people have got. Because, if anything's going to save us, it's going to be the working class, and they're not going to do it if they're too depressed to act. Mm-hmm.
Janet, do you want to come back on that?
No, I take your point. It's absolutely valid.
Okay, Dougie.
Well, I mean, I've got a friend and he knows somebody who played for Partick Thistle when they won some sort of cup or whatever. And he played golf for this guy. And this guy said to my friend, he said, it's better to be an optimist, even although you might be wrong some of the time. But if you're a pessimist, you'll always be right. And I think that's how I view things. You've got to try and look on things potentially being solved or whatever. I know capitalism seems to be going to hell in a handcart, but I mean, it's better to be optimistic and put your politics forward and listen, what, as Paddy says, read the science and see what the potential is to solve these problems. So I mean, that's all I want to say, right? Yeah.
You need to be an optimist to play for Partick Thistle.
Yeah, I think that's when Partick Thistle were a good team, I think. Yeah.
Oh, now we're going back.
We're going back quite a while, yeah.
Not wrong with Partick Thistle. They're a great local team, they really are. Many a good team out up in the west end of Glasgow. Awesome.
And Paddy, you talk about the working class being so clever and ingenious, and the fat cats doing sod all and being capable of sod all. But how come they're in the position that they're in, and we're in the position that we're in? We ain't that clever.
Sorry, did you want me to answer that?
I think she did.
Yeah, why not?
Well, I don't really need to, do I? I mean, this is what we're trying to do. This is what the Socialist Party is trying to do. We're trying to change the consciousness. We're not getting very far at the moment, but you know, who knows what's around the next corner?
The Socialist Party is trying.
You're right. All we can do is try.
Yeah, Paddy. Can I say something? Yeah. I think you were talking about technology, not science. The examples you gave were all about technology. At the captain's class, the idea that they're just fat, lazy people, you know, rich people doing nothing. I don't think Putin, who's a capitalist, member of the capitalist class, is doing nothing. I don't think most of those dictators... Oh, I do nothing, but they're members of the capitalist class. And that's the image we have to look at.
Was that directed at you, Paddy?
Yeah. Well, I don't need to answer that particularly, do I?
No. Anyone else? Let's chip in. Alan?
Yeah, it's perhaps just that we need to recognise that there is actually a divide between the urban and the rural. So much is UK-centric or Western in Western industrial world-centric, and we need to see that there is another world out there.
Yeah, most people see it as a holiday world, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I mean, putting on a personal note, I know you said maybe you'd be coming to Turkey sometime, and I said to you, I'll take you and show you a different world. I mean, that's not a it's just. Really, it's important that people see that where they live, where they are, their privileges and their that's not the real world. It's a small portion of the real world. The real world has a very different perspective, and I think Carla, any members of the party, would be interested to see what some of our neighbours. Would express to them about the world in general, a moneyless world, socialism, the problems with capitalism. They've got an incredible grasp on it. I mean, they may not express it in strictly party political terms, but they have an incredible grasp on it because they live it all day, every day. And we need to recognize that we're in a bubble. Janet and I are in a bubble. You are in a bubble. We need to see that the world that we live in our bubble is not necessarily the real world. It can be very different, I actually believe the real world, as I see it, gives us hope for humanity. That's it. Thank you.
Yeah, I get that, Alan. And I have some experience of that as a child. Going back to Italy, my grandparents were subsistence farmers. And that life was very different. And I do, I have some experience of that. Malcolm?
Somebody was talking about Gramsci earlier on. Another thing that Gramsci said was those furthest from the means of production have the most novel solutions. And when you're talking about, and somebody else was talking about Brazil, I think, I used to think the Brazilian rainforest was completely natural, but I actually find out the rainforest has been grown by humans, basically. There's a thing in the Brazilian rainforest called Black Earth, and it's basically, it's made by natives. I'm not going into great detail on how it's made, because it's a bit, but I think we could learn from the indigenous people are taking care of places like the Brazilian rainforest, and you could learn a lot from them when you're talking about the Western perspective. I've learned from people that actually have stayed there and lived there for centuries. If you look into this Black Earth stuff, the Brazilian rainforest, it was very thin soil, and the people grew amazing vertical gardens. I'm talking about vertical gardens as well. People grew amazing gardens and managed to feed themselves in this very thin soil. Obviously, when the white men first went, they were looking down their noses at these people instead of learning from them. Anyway.
I mean, he's right, isn't he? So everything is so Western perspective.
I don't understand what is here.
Anyone else like to chip in? We've been nearly 2 hours now. So you've obviously stimulated quite a good discussion, Janet. Well done, you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate everybody's input. I really do. It's a lot to think about. And I also will stress again what a wonderful opportunity this has been, the whole Discord thing. And long may it live. Thanks, everybody.
Excellent. So if everybody's okay with it, shall we call it a night?
Okay with me.
Thanks, Janet.
Pleasure.
Nice one, Janet.
Thank you.